Hello, and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, the smart pop culture podcast for people who like smart pop culture and podcasts. My name's Andrew Harrison, and joining me, I've got Sean Pattenden, the otherworldly, alas, insane, to my short white duck. Yes, it's Poey Week again. Hello, Sean. How are you?
Very well, thank you, Andrew.
I very much enjoyed your free-floating chat with Paul Molly and Michael Moran last week while I was away. I had no idea that all those ZCT record sleeves are finished before the records are even done.
Absolutely. They used to sit on the mixing desk as Trevor Horn was mixing and people were recording.
So he's making relaxing, he can focus on a picture of a lady in a leather jacket with no pants on.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe that helped.
I wonder what Holly and Paul and the lads thought about this.
Yeah, I thought Morley skipped round those questions. What did the stars think?
You know, don't let the talent near the record. It's the best idea in the entire world of pop music.
Yeah.
As is traditional, we have two top draw guests with us this week. Mark Hooper is a returning Big Mouth regular and the editor of Hole and Corner magazine, the periodical of handmade crafts and things made out of bits of wood and so on. He's also a Bowie nut, which is going to come in very handy later because we're going to be talking about Loving the Alien, an 11-CD box set of the Dame's contentious 1980s output, as well as the first album in 6 years by troubled multi-genre pilgrim Cat Power, which is fittingly called Wanderer, plus our guest's choice of the emergency movie that they'd suggest for an empty evening when you've got literally nothing left on the skybox. But anyway, let's meet Mark. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Oh, very good, thanks.
Welcome back. What's been happening in Hole and Corner world lately?
We've just had our fifth birthday issue come out, actually, so that's quite an achievement in itself, being around for 5 years.
You're now literally vintage. What's in it?
There's amazing French art, because I should point out, we're not just about craft, and it's kind of a bit of a play because people always, you know, say, oh, you do that magazine about potting and the clay and stuff. And so we've got this French artist called Olivier de Sagazan, who's kind of, he's like a performance artist and he uses clay, but he like covers his face and creates these sort of alien figures and stuff. He starts off like a businessman in a suit and starts smearing his face and it becomes like a sort of weird horror movie. And he's been around for years, but he's a completely crazy French guy. And he's just sort of been picked up by a hip-hop artist, you know, and he's so sort of cute about it. He's like, I have very lots of friends in the art world, and now these lovely musicians from Chicago are calling me for to be a video and stuff. And stuff. You know, he's sort of become this kind of like performance artist in pop videos.
Can he actually bury Kanye West in clay?
Just leave it to dry.
We're going to be talking about David Bowie's least handmade period a bit later, the Let's Dance Tonight era when everything was overproduced. However, if somebody was to start selling glass spiders, handmade glass spiders right now, they would do a bomb, wouldn't it? David Bowie, actual handmade glass spider.
Yeah, probably would.
Louise Bourgeois, I thought.
Yeah.
Mm. The theme of the new issue of Hole and Corner is literally Earth, Wind and Fire.
It is indeed, the elements.
Is there a Maurice White tribute?
I kept saying that as well, and people saying, you know, that's not actually the four elements.
It doesn't matter. Well, I mean, lots of people used to kind of collect records now go in for, you know, limited pottery and art stuff because it's got the same tactile quality that music used to have and doesn't have anymore, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, it's kind of, I think it's just sort of people, you know, we sort of focus on people who create stuff in the wider sense. We do have musicians and you know, artists. We've featured Peter Blake before, and it's just people who kind of care about what they do and the process. It doesn't have to be handmade, but it's just the processes and do things in an interesting way, really, I suppose.
Moral, invest in stuff.
Also joining us today is Caroline Katz, a writer, actor and all-round good egg and another Bowie nut. You may recognise her from roles in Doc Martin and DCI Banks, but she is also a director of proper music documentaries with real deep mojo and quietus value. Her debut, Message to the World, Whatever Happened to Jesse Hector, told the story of the mutton-chopped former leader of Crush Butler and the Hammersmith Gorillaz, two bands who make Slade look like Classics Nouveau after his strange afterlife. Now, her short film, Delia Derbyshire, The Myths and the Legendary Tapes, is about to be screened as part of the BFI London Film Festival. Hello, Caroline. How are you?
Welcome. Hello, I'm very well. Thank you for having me, Big Mouth.
What made you want to make a movie about Delia Derbyshire? Are you a long-time fan?
I am a long-time fan. I think she's one of the most fascinating female composers ever. I obviously, you know, starts off with Doctor Who. You find out whenever, you know, that she is behind this incredible sound that she collaborated with, you know, Ron Grainer on, who's the composer of the music, but she actually crafted it. So that's where it all begins, of course. And then you see these incredible images of this extraordinary looking sort of demure woman and you sort of creating sort of tapestries of sound with these... And you just think, how did she actually do it? So I started to look into that. And when I sort of realised that note by note, sequence by sequence, she sort of built these sort of incredible performances up. They became like sort of solo performances. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, there was no sequences then. So it's all these different tape machines that are synced together. And I know that everybody at that point was making these, was working in that way. But she had the most delicate touch and I think the most incredible way of making it sound otherworldly and extraordinary. I love all of her pieces. Mm. And also, the stuff that we know is really sort of the scratch on the surface of it, because there's 267 tapes that are at the moment in her archive in Manchester University at John Ryland's Library that are phenomenal. And I've been there quite a few times. Mm. So it started with the archive and then came the short film.
Yeah, you say otherworldly, but obviously she used all these amazing wine bottles and household objects to make them music.
Yeah, some of it was found sound, but also electronics, you know, using oscillators and everything. Yeah.
She's become quite a hero of the electronic world, the St. Delia of the tapes. What's the secret of her appeal, do you think, more so than someone like Daphne Oram, who I don't think has quite the cachet?
I think the appeal of Delia is, you know, this thing of it. Her music, this avant-garde music infiltrating the mainstream, mm-hmm. and people know her more because of that, because of Doctor Who, so it's easier to sort of key into what she was doing. So it's more, her stuff is more available. But also she has this quality that's, I can't really, you have to, each piece has something unique and extraordinary about it. And I think it's, are you about to play one of them?
We've got a track actually, yes.
Yes, because there's a good story for this.
There's a lot of rare tapes that you just mentioned and they've turned out to be very prescient, haven't they? This one, I think, is just tagged as Delia's experimental dance track and it's got an introduction from Delia herself.
Forget about this, it's for interest only. Okay, coming up.
Delia Derbyshire from 1971, sounding like she's on Warp Records in 2018. Caroline, what's the story behind this then?
Well, what you've just heard is actually not really 100% Delia.
Oh,
okay. But it is legit because it's David Butler, who is looks after the archive at Manchester University, has done an incredible job of digitising it, looking after it, and has now passed it over to the John Ryland's Library, where it has this wonderful room where it lives in. And he put together in 2008, when the archive started to be open, a compilation to the BBC. And this was a compilation of various elements from the archive. Mm. And the track is called Dance from Noah. And it was an original... it was a piece that actually was for a school's programme about Noah's Ark.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah. I want to be on that rave Ark. That's fantastic.
But actually, this sound is just a component. It's just one of the many, many elements that they only discovered when they were digitising the tapes. They found, you know, loads of different elements. Mm. And this is just the drum track that's underneath, or that sound that's underneath, that you don't really hear when you hear the full Dance from Noah, because it's sort of so couched and bedded in. So really, it's not that she created this as a piece, and it's sort of like early dance music. I guess there's many, if you unpicked all of her tracks, you would find 1,000 like this.
It's a Delia Derbyshire bonus beats.
So actually, yes, sort of, it is her, but it's been sort of helped along by David Butler sort of picking it out, really.
Obviously, Delia's story is a bit of a tragic one in that she had a serious alcohol problem later in life and a bit of a chaotic lifestyle. She never quite in life got the appreciation that she's now getting. People like Sonic Boom wanted to work with her, and she did some other stuff. Do you think that they're kind of, you know, the sort of the, you know, that sort of questionable romance of A Tragic Life is part of the reason that she's so loved now, because she didn't really get
I don't know. I question the narrative of the tragic, mm-hmm. the tragic Delia. I think that sort of denies her the agency she had over the choices she made. I think she got to a point where, I mean, this is, you know, from what I've been looking into and thinking about, you just wonder whether or not it was time for her to move into another world, a world that, you know, the workshop was becoming almost a service provider. It was slightly a victim of its own success, as far as I understand it. This stuff was coming in at a huge, you know, a huge rate. They couldn't keep up with the amount of stuff. She was under huge pressure. She's a creative artist. She wanted to have some space, and off she went. Mm. She left and she went to Cumbria and she found some peace there, and actually worked at a gallery at the in Cumbria at Hadrian's Wall called the LYC Museum with an artist called Li Wenxia, a Taiwanese artist. So I think she did. We found out since too that she's also created tracks for art films in 74, and I think another one in 70. I think later on in 76. So the work doesn't just stop.
Yeah.
It carries on, but she has more control over her life in terms of her alcoholism. I think, yes, I'm sure that was a terrible plague on her, blight in her life, but it is for so many people.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps the narrative's been slightly tragedized, if you like, and it's worth rethinking.
Did you find out any more about this fabled meeting with Paul McCartney, where originally Yesterday was going to be an electronic wonky
Well,
thing?
The only thing I know about that is that for some books it says, oh, he came to the workshop. I don't think he did. I think he went to Peter Zinoviev's place at EMS in Putney. And it was when she was working with Unit Delta Plus later on that she met him. That's what I believe. And I've heard that from a few different people, and I wonder. Yeah. Yes,
in my head, Yesterday is much better if it goes with its blinky blonky.
I agree.
Much better.
Do you think that the tapes, of which, as you say, there are very, very many, are we likely to hear any of this stuff that she recorded up to 2001?
I think what's brilliant about the archive is it's available to anybody. You can go, you can visit, and there's a lot of artists working with it, writers and musicians, composers, everybody, and I wonder what the next step will be with it. Yeah.
Yeah. When is the film out?
Well, it will be screening at the London Film Festival on the 16th and 17th of October at the Prince Charles Theatre and also the View Leicester Square. It's all there on the website, and it's there on my Twitter page if you want to go and find it.
And if you're not in London, will there be a chance to see us at some point at the end of the year?
Well, I wonder. Yes, there'll be ways and means. I will look into those for sure. Yeah.
Excellent, Delia Derbyshire. Right, before we dive into the giant David Bowie hamper, just a quick reminder that you can get a little bit more Big Mouth every week if you back us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Help us to cover our studio costs with a small contribution, a mere £5 a month, or the price of a moderately classy pint, and we'll send you an extra bit every week exclusively to Patreon backers. Our guests are going to stick around for a bit after the show, and Patreon backers will get an email for the extra bit as soon as it's ready. Go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. All we are saying is buy us a pint. Anyway, let's move on to your friendly neighbourhood Glass Spider-Man. This month sees the release of Loving the Alien, the latest comprehensive David Bowie box set, this time covering what even card-carrying space cadets would probably consider the Dame's least loved years, the 1980s, when the former thin white Aladdin Stardust grew a mullet, adopted the big brash sound of the time, and, as the Americans say, went for the brass ring of enormous mainstream stadium success. Over 11 discs, Loving the Alien brings together his three 80s albums, Let's Dance Tonight and Live and Let Me Down, plus the requisite tons of live material and period remixes. Most interestingly, there's a full redo of Never Let Me Down, with the gauche 80s production stripped away to reveal the songs as Bowie probably always wanted them to sound. Or did he? How can we ever know? Are we too hard on 80s Bowie, and does this period deserve another chance? We're going to talk about it, and whether restoring records to a natural state that never really existed is strictly on. After this, from the new version of Never Let Me Down, this is the MM cleanup of Time Will Crawl.
I saw a black
Time Will Crawl 2018, although I think it was actually 2008, from the David Bowie 80s box set Loving the Alien. Caroline, that was a time when a lot of us were experiencing Bowie firsthand for the first time, you know, instead of going through older siblings' record collections. Is history hard on 80s Bowie? Is it unfair to him?
Yes, I like to think of them as the difficult years, the difficult for me years. Oh God, it's very difficult, isn't it, how to explain this. Probably like many of us here, came to Bowie from those earlier albums. Mm. I don't really know how or why. I suppose they were around a lot in early 80s, but in where I lived, just outside Manchester, little record shop, the only Bowie albums they had were Ziggy and Pin-Ups, and which were two very strange ones to start out on Bowie. And the reason why I chose them were because I just love the covers.
Yeah.
And I was young. I was ridiculously... I went with my pocket money and saved up. And then on my whatever it was birthday, Scary Monsters came out. And my folks said, how about that for your birthday?
Oh.
And
I said... Forward-looking parents.
No, yeah. No, I can't. Okay. Because I didn't like what I'd heard. And I couldn't actually bear listening or Ashes to Ashes or Lo, I Love the Video. Mm. I didn't understand how that fitted in with my Ziggy album and my Pin-Ups album. Yeah. And I had this sort of vision of him already formed in my head. And although I could see it on the video, I didn't like the sound. Uh-huh. So I've only recently come to Scary Monsters. Can you believe that?
Mark, you're a proper Bowie fiend. Was your love of the name formed during the 80s when he was this David?
Very similar to Caroline, really. I was born in 72, which is Ziggy Stardust year, and I think when Changes came out, because he did the track listing for that, and there was a very specific... I was reading in Dylan Jones's book about how he was very specific about wanting to rewrite his history and say these are, you know, so it wasn't the obvious all the big hit singles. It was like, this is, you know, if you're coming new to me, this is what it should be. So I think that's the first time I heard, and that got me into things like Ziggy and Ashes to Ashes. Similarly, though, I didn't like the album. I thought it was too weird and quite difficult to get into. But Ashes to Ashes video, I think I was probably 8 when that came out. So that was really, that really stayed with me and really struck me. And I remember. But the thing about all that period, as you were saying, the album covers and the visuals and the stagecraft, it was so, everything was so perfect and ahead of its time and influential. In the 80s, suddenly, like, beyond the music, just the way he was dressing, like, what are you doing? You don't look like... And it's, in a way, I think it probably was a bit of a weird experiment. Like, oh, let's be a proper, you know, megastar and see what that's like and dress and behave like that. And there's one of the earlier documentaries I was in, they all saying, like, who's this weird bloke who's smiling and being nice to everybody? It's like, this isn't the David Bowie we know. I found it... It's interesting listening to a lot of it again. And I think the thing that really struck me is... Even through that period where I didn't really like any of the albums, the singles are really amazing, brilliant singles. Yeah. And they're, you know, you can just tell they're hits just, you know, as soon as you put them on. But a lot of them are really nostalgic. It's like, you know, Modern Love, Absolute Beginners, Blue Jean.
I actually love Blue Jean.
I genuinely love all those singles, but they're not, he used to be ahead of, and it's almost like he's looking back at his record collection doing kind of strange pastiches of earlier music.
There's an alternative point of view which says that he's done that throughout his career, that, you know, Ziggy Stardust is a nostalgic record. Diamond Dogs is a nostalgic record. But they're all nostalgic to the days of, like, quiffs and saxophones.
It is, but it's quiffs, but then, like, a spaceman doing that. So it's kind of taking that and looking forwards, whereas I think a lot of this is kind of weirdly looking back, isn't it?
It's definitely the case that the standout on this is that it is full of amazing singles. Like, half of Let's Dance is singles. Mm-hmm. And they're all, it's, you know, Modern Love, Johnny Gill, they're all fantastic, you know, Cat People. Even Tonight, which is allegedly where The Rot is set in, because essentially he's run out of songs. He's he hasn't had time to write. So
there's only two new ones on
there. Yeah, he's reusing old indie pop stuff and there's a cover on them. But even that, you know, it's got Loving the Alien on it, which is one of the greatest movie records of all time. And, you know, Blue Jean's pretty amazing. And so, you know, that really stood out for me. And Absolute Beginners, which isn't even an album track, is in many ways ultimate Bowie song.
I love that, actually.
That he was terrible in the 80s just doesn't stand up in that respect. Then again, the stinkers are stinkers.
The thing is, there's so much content he's got. He's created, you know, Sian and I over the years have discussed.
We have discussed rather a lot.
The Bowie continuum. The Bowie continuum
is very important.
That's the fascinating thing for me, is the ever-changing. And even if it's not going places you want to go, it's where he's taking
it's his
you.
Story and it's his mistakes.
And it has these fascinating things. These experiments. Experiments don't always work, do they? Yeah.
So Let's Dance is the first album that I heard by David Bowie completely. Yeah. I don't have older siblings. I listen to the radio. There was no one telling me what to listen to, and that's it. So I made my mistakes. I love Let's Dance. I love that album, and I put it on at the weekend to say, and just blasting Modern Love out in the kitchen. It was just like, it's to me, that's still really exciting. It was the idea that this is pop music, and this is what fame is. That's really 1983. Mm, someone said it's 1983 in a bottle. This is what I am going to try and do. As Mark says, I'm going to be this megastar. I'm going to act this part, and as an album as a whole, it's completely cohesive, really danceable. And I was listening in retrospect, you know, we sort of unearth this culture all the time, but sort of curating, unearthing like an archaeologist, I can hear all this Iggy Pop in it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the songs he wrote with Iggy for Tonight or are Iggy songs, but that call and response he's got, you can see those threads. And what's so nice is it's fine to fail. It's all right. Tonight, I feel, maybe not his best album, Never Let Me Down, maybe not. But just to be able to listen to that, I thought was enormously gratifying. A whole weekend of David Bowie was wonderful.
Yeah, I enjoyed it an awful lot more than I was
expecting. Really enjoyed it, yeah.
What did we think of the two versions of Never Let Me Down? Because Never Let Me Down is the 80s, I suppose. Everything's thwacking, the synthesised saxophones everywhere. Mega overproduced. And I've always liked Time Will Crawl as a song, the version that we just heard.
Yeah, it's
which basically got rid of all the crap and made it sound like a Smith song almost.
Yeah.
It's not as fully realised on the rest of the album, on the rest of the new version of the album, not as fully kind of spruced as what we just heard.
No, I expected bigger changes and it didn't sound that different to me. But if you hear, I was listening to the drums on Never Let Me Down, they are whacked up, they're really, really loud.
Yeah, So I thought
I'm going to listen to Addicted to Love because I'm sure they're the same drum. No, the drums on Addicted to Love are really low compared to this. It's really maxed out. It sounds really druggy to me, apparently, though, he wasn't taking all the drugs that he used to.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds quite cokey, doesn't it?
Yes.
The whole thing.
Well, this is also the period when apparently he went off the jazz salt and to an extent. I did find myself thinking I would actually really like to hear Tin Machine play some of these songs. band playing.
Well, Tin Machine's on some of the
it's becoming Tin Machine, isn't it? Also, interesting artifact in here. There's two live albums on here. There's the Serious Moonlight Tour. Under the Moonlight, the Serious Moonlight. And then there's the Glass Spider Tour, which goes down as one of the great follies in the history of rock. Serious Moonlight is a fantastic band. It's Earl Slick, Tony Thompson from Chic. And you get the idea that he can take this he's doing that thing of putting Bowieism on a big stage. And, there's a few bits of annoying popping saxophone, but generally it works pretty well, I thought. Glass Spider is when it all starts to get just to topple over, I think, because there's this... There's all these kind of am-dram call and response bits in the middle where he's kind of trying to put this framework of a story about a glass spider that doesn't really make an awful lot of sense.
And he has to sing under that enormous... I was looking at the YouTube footage as well of that ridiculous glass spider. It doesn't hold up well.
But I sort of think in this box you can sort of tell that he kind of knows it's going wrong and he needs to become somebody else. He knows it's kind of... He's explored it as fully as he possibly can. And then, of course, the next thing is Tin Machine, which has its own kind of... detractors and its own boosters, but it's him trying to become the person he would be in the 21st century. I don't think you get modern Bowie and the amazing kind of late flowering without all of this, do you?
It's the continuum, it's part of the story.
And also you wonder, who did he have around him when he was trying to do those theatre shows? Who was actually there matching the vision and going, actually... Dave, I'm not sure about this. Do you really want to do that with the
Peter
phone box?
Frampton, David Bowie in Madrid getting the beer that annoys everyone, but I quite like it.
That bit of footage on
YouTube must have been on this tour because it's 87. So that is his quiffy, ridiculous, I'm the most famous person in the world era, isn't it?
I think that this is the Sylvester McCoy of David Bowie. I think it's the one. It's never going to be the best one, but much better than people remember. Much more likable than people remember.
I really enjoyed it.
I don't know why people have such knee-jerk resistance to the 80s because the young people love the 80s. Walk down my street in trendy East London, they've all got David Bowie's haircut.
Oh, very true.
And his shirt as well.
Yeah.
So better than we remember. If you like Big Mouth, you'll enjoy another music podcast that we produce. It's called Be There, and it's brought to you by Dali Loudspeakers, Danish manufacturers of super high-end audio gear with beautiful Scandinavian design. In each episode, I sit down with the cream of music journalism, including a few Big Mouth favourites, to talk about the stories behind great recordings, old and new. Here's a snippet from the new series. This is Kate Hutchinson of The Guardian talking about the remarkable story of Analog Africa Records and its founder, Sami Ben Redjeb, a man who built his entire life around his obsession with the out-there sounds of Africa.
Well, here's a real character, Sammy, and he...
I can't exactly remember, or I don't know how he discovered that his love of African music, but he really went to superb lengths to go and find a lot of this stuff, including, so I think he went to Senegal, where he was a diving instructor, and then he loved it so much, and then he became a DJ in hotels in order to stay there and to find as much music as he can. And then he was like, how can I enable myself to travel around Africa cheaply and go on these massive record hunts? And he decided the best way to do that would be to be a flight attendant. So he got a job at Lufthansa, and this was right after 9/11. So A, not many people wanted to be flight attendants, and B, he managed to negotiate a deal where he could be part-time. So he was part-time flying across Africa, and then the rest of the week he was going to various countries and sort of finding what he could find.
It's astonishing, isn't it? I love the idea of him sort of getting on playing with the duty free and a huge rattling bag of cassettes from Africa. Explain what's actually happening in that, on that label, the Analog Africa label, and that kind of world of music, because it has become the kind of undiscovered treasure trove of mad sounds you can't get anywhere else, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the key is that Sammy has a certain style. So there are a lot of reissue labels now. It is kind of the thing. And Africa, the continent, as well as the Middle East, is somewhere that's really kind of being mined for as much kind of old stuff as possible. But Sammy has a particular ear for, he likes old, weird dance music and synth music.
A bit of Be There With Dali for you there. Search Be There With Dali on your favourite podcast app for the full show, and subscribe for a new episode every 2 weeks.
Let's move on to some enormously contemporary music. Each week we ask our guests to bring in a tune they're enjoying, their editor's recommendation. Caroline Katz, what have you brought in for us today?
Well, I've brought in a Yoko Ono track called Yes, I'm a Witch, and there's two versions of it, and I think you're going to play one of the brilliant versions.
Not the rubbish one, yeah.
Which is remixed in 2007 by the Brother Brothers. She did it with them on an album where people kind of went through the A Story album, and she got artists involved, and they sort of redid her, you know, what do you call it? Cover versions and various, but sometimes with her. This one was with her. I absolutely love this version. The 1974 version is amazing as well. It's much more funky. It's quite got this kind of funky band behind her. Not at all heavy. It's quite sort of gentle and very strange. Mm. But this is heavy and exciting, and I love it.
Let's have a listen. This is Yoko Ono with Yes, I'm a Witch.
Each time we get to do what we want to do, we're living. We open our minds to what we see, we're living. Yes, I'm a witch, I'm a bitch, I don't care what you say. My voice is real, my voice is truth, don't fit in your ways. I'm not gonna die for you, you might as well face the truth. I'm gonna stick around for quite a while, bitch, bitch.
That was Yoko Ono, Yes, I'm a Witch, as chosen by Caroline Katz. And sticking with hardcore woman power music, Cat Power, a.k.a. Chan Marshall, has been in the wars throughout her career, experiencing drink problems and breakdowns in the noughties and hospitalisations for more mundane health problems in recent years. It's all kind of overshadowed her music, which evolved from a sort of riot girl funk in the 90s through soul, pop, electronics and beyond. And she's not very happy about it. There's always been an exploitation of my vulnerability, she told Marianne Hobbs recently. It's demeaned my professionalism and it's demeaned my stature. New album Wanderer is out now, and it strips the epic production of previous records back to something very intimate. What's it like, and is it any good? We're going to find out after this track, Woman, featuring guest singer Lana Del Rey.
Woman, 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 woman.
And Lana Del Rey with Woman from the album Wanderer. Are you a follower of Cat Power? Are you a believer in Cat Power?
No. I'm not. I enjoyed this album, actually. Mm. And I was trying very hard not to, you know, to imagine if it was... I find it's very difficult, isn't it? I don't know how music journalists and people evaluate music on the basis of what if it's good or not, if they don't love it. I just find it really hard to subjectively, you know, to sort of objectively look at, listen to something and have a view on it. I didn't like it. I would never buy it. I would never listen to it. But I could very much imagine walking around Oliver Bonass when I was at a railway station somewhere and having to be forced to listen to it and thinking, this is not terrible. I quite like it. And actually, probably Woman would be good, and it will probably be a massive hit. That's my prediction.
Yeah. Mark, what did you reckon? Have you been following her?
I mean, she passed me by slightly before. Sounds like it was a small period, but I know she's been around for years. But I remember The Greatest, that was quite a bit. And it became sort of, I remember she became very sort of fashionable. She like, her music would suddenly appear on catwalk shows and stuff, and it was kind of cool to be into her and stuff. And I kind of liked her and the fact that she was around and, you know, kind of a sort of a strong, respected woman, I suppose. But never really kind of, I never owned any of her albums, but I did really like this. I love the kind of sort of kind of almost like ghostly, almost like kind of Americana. I've got to say, when I was listening to it to begin with, there's a problem with my headphones, and you know when the connection isn't properly, and there's a cover of a Rihanna song. I was like, this is unbelievable. It's like this weird ghostly vocals which come in and come out, and it goes all glitchy and stuff. And I push my headphones, and it's like, oh, actually, it's just a straight
your imagination.
So I should do a remix like that. Really. But yeah, I did. It's, you know, it's not my favourite, but it's, you know, it's much more my taste than her earlier stuff, I think.
Yeah.
It's very, very, very low key and kind of just piano and guitar. And sometimes it sounds like it's recorded outdoors or in a shed or something like that. She's like taking it right back.
Yes, but then at the same time, really overproduced on the vocals and things. That's what got me. It's supposed to be stripped down and yet felt incredibly contrived and produced to make it be like that. That's what I think bugged me about it quite a lot. What do you think? Am I wrong?
Okay. Laura Marling sounds like that. And the first time I heard Laura Marling, I thought, well, why is she kind of a folky sort of singer? And there's masses of auto-tune. I didn't understand. I think it's a modern thing. And because Cat Power has done some sort of more techno electronic style music in her few last albums, she's used to sort of fusing the two. And I think it's meant to be a fusion. Now, the first time I put this on, I thought, well, this isn't for me. But I listened to it a few times, and actually I think the songs are really beautiful on it. Stay. You really listen to it, the melody and the sentiment and everything else. I just thought, oh, I can really get this. There's something about it that if you live with it for a bit, I don't get tragic person who's bearing her soul. I just got a really, really beautiful songwriting coming out of it. And I actually thought, if I gave it the time, the problem I have with her is I get her confused with Juliana Hatfield. I get her confused with Tanya Donnelly. There's a sort of certain indie chick that she gets lumped in with, but I think that's our fault more than hers. I think there's a lot more to her.
Do we think that female artists kind of get buried under their story?
Definitely.
I mean, I literally just did it myself.
That's 100%.
I literally did it.
So. I think that's and also I think Delia is a case in point.
How we were talking about Delia is how we're talking about Cat Power. So we do obviously have a problem with a woman's narrative.
And yet, she's got Lana Del Rey on the track that we just heard. And, you know, yes, Tragic Woman is a terrible stereotype, but it is very successful with female audiences as well as male.
Yeah.
It produces amazing music from Dusty Springfield all the way through to Bat for Lashes and whomever. And sadness and tragedy are primal things in pop, and pop is there for primal things. So are we kind of,
I don't think it's just a female thing, because, like, you know, most of country music is that, isn't
it? Yeah, no one would say it about a man.
I know, but they don't really focus on the alcoholism and the drugs. They just go, oh, of course he does that, he's a boy.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway,
girls aren't
he left his wife and all his kids and everything. Oh, don't worry about that. They listen to the sound they're making. This is his artistic contribution. Yeah. It's not all plugged into, you know, his personal life or whatever.
I saw her live once and she really did. She sat like a tiny little mouse and made herself very, very small, and she had one electric guitar and she whispered through a 30-minute set. Almost, it was at the point where she was doing her back to the audience stuff, and I thought, I'm finding her difficult to like. But, you know, I quite like it now. Yoko Ono sat with her back to the audience, so there you go.
I did think it was, because the engineer worked with Elliot Smith, didn't he? And the production feels very like that, and it's got that quite vulnerability, which I do really like that, so. Yeah, it's got a nice...
It definitely feels vulnerable. And I think, you know, even though with all the saying about it being overproduced and things like that from my side, there is some thread through it that is really strong and powerful. You know, that it would be good to hear it it's good to hear
she's
it as an
fighter,
album rather in
lover.
Isolation. It's,
yeah.
There's a proper story there.
So overall, are we going to be listening to this again and again? Do you think?
I almost might. I almost might stick it on the background because I say the more you listen to it, the more you get the hooks, and the songwriting is just fantastic. She's a really good songwriter, and
Caroline,
I don't think
I'm getting a big no from you. Yeah. I don't think you're going to be.
No, I don't think I'll be revisiting it. But I, like I say, when I will inevitably find myself in Topshop or Oliver Bonass or one of those kinds of places, I will hear it a lot. And I will keep going, oh, I like that one. And then I'll remember it's from that album that I should probably go back and listen to. Yeah.
Yeah. Songs for Bonass. I just thought it was all right. I like it when she does the bigger music. I like it when she does, you know, Sun and the electronic things.
Can't believe we've just plugged Oliver Bonass. My worst, most hated shop on the planet, by the way.
Right, that's all well and good. But it's time for some more music from Mark Hooper. You've brought in something for us. What is it?
Yeah, it's from Prince's new album. It's basically an album of piano. Well, they call them demos. Not really. It's just like a piano rehearsal, I think. So it's half an hour. Seems like a continuous track, unless they've edited it pretty cleverly, called Piano and a Microphone. And it's basically a mixture of covers, some genuine demos and stuff. There's a Joni Mitchell cover and some unreleased stuff. And the opening track is 17 Days, which was the B-side to When Doves Cry. And if you've heard that, it actually, I think it's kind of weird sort of pop quiz fact, it turned up on as B-side on another single, Later Girls and Boys. But it's very sort of Purple Rain, psychedelia, chucking everything, including the kitchen sink at it, loads of electronic backing. And this is just like, you know, it's like a proper piano maestro doing all that on a piano, talking to the engineer. And I love, there's a bit at the moment where, you know, the drums come in and he starts doing the drums with his all like, doom, 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 at least while he's singing and playing. And it's just like, just an album start like that, and you just think, oh my God, who is this guy? And it's the fact that he did this before he became a superstar. I mean, he was already well known, but it's before Purple Rain came out, and there's an early demo of Purple Rain on it. And there's Strange Relationship. It's like 5 years before the Sign of the Times album came out. So it's just half an hour of listening to an absolute genius at work.
Continuing our Deceased Legends Week this week, here we go. It's Prince on the Purple Piano.
Called you yesterday. You answer your phone. Main check, knowing that you're probably weren't alone.
Turn the voice down a little.
Wanna call you every day, beg you to be near me. I know your head is underwater. I doubt that you could hear me.
Prince playing 17 Days on the piano from the album Piano and a Microphone. Now, finally, listeners, what's your emergency movie? The one where, if one of your friends says, I have literally no idea what to watch tonight, you'd recommend it without hesitation. We're not talking Infinity War or Mamma Mia 2 here. People could come up with those themselves. We're talking about the less obvious ones. Mark, Caroline, Sean and I have chosen ours, and we're going to talk about them in a minute and explain why they're great. Ordinarily, we play an excerpt from one of the films here, but literally none of them makes any sense in clip form. So here's a song from the soundtrack to My Choice. I can't believe I'm playing this. It's Joan Baez.
Ooh.
With the title track from Douglas Trumbull's Greenhouse in Space classic, Silent Running.
Joan Baez with the title track to Silent Running. We're asking our guests for their emergency movie, and that was Andrew's choice, which we'll come on to later. Caroline, you've chosen something called Faces Places. What is this?
Well, yeah, first of all, I didn't choose Faces Places, to be honest. First of all, I chose The White Bus by Lindsay Anderson, but it's actually impossible to get hold of.
It is.
I had to get it from Australia, which will bring me to another thing later.
Yes.
But anyway, I chose Faces Places. It is a bit of a sort of lazy choice because I just saw it on Sunday.
Mm.
I didn't see it in the cinema. I did that brilliant thing that really excites me when you can watch it at home when it's still playing in the cinema, which still makes me really happy.
That new thing,
is so good. Because when you can't get out, you can actually watch stuff with your kids. It's brilliant. Anyway, so Faces Places is an Agnès Varda film, and I love Agnès Varda. And this time, in collaboration with JR, a a photographer, artist, brilliant artist, who she connects with, and they travel around the French countryside together, meeting local residents, and then they produce these absolute. They drive around in a sort of a van, which has got a big camera on both sides. I mean, an image of a big camera on both sides, and then they stop it somewhere, and they will get a sort of local person to come sit down, have their photograph taken. There's a giant printer in there, and out the side of it, it's like a sort of giant instant camera. Mm. These images come out. At first, when I saw it, he was explaining it as they were driving along, and I was thinking, oh, it's a joke, it's really funny. I was laughing. Yeah. Oh, imagine if that happened. And then it starts to happen before your eyes, and you realise that that is actually what they're doing. But it's just really touching, very, very beautiful. The people that they visit, and the things you find out about the stories of the people along the way. And then on the buildings or on their places of work, they sort of construct these absolutely giant sort of, you know, 20-foot images of these people, sort of turning them into these, you know, iconic images that will stay there. And it's just seeing people's reaction to that and how they communicate with their sort of subjects, and it's just really very, very touching. It's got quite a sort of sad, sweet, bittersweet ending. She spends the whole time, I'm not going to obviously ruin it, but she does spend the whole time trying to get JR to take his glasses off.
Oh, right.
And you do think, JR, why are you wearing glasses? And this shows how nice JR is, because you think, why are you wearing sunglasses all the way through? Come rain, shine, indoors, outdoors, it's really quite irritating, JR. You know, he's 31 or something. But actually, you love him so much. He's such a great, lovely person, but he just doesn't want to show his eyes. And she tries to get to the bottom of that, and she manages to do that by the end, but through a very sad little moment where they go and visit Jean-Luc Godard. But I'm going to have to leave that with you.
Okay, do.
No spoilers.
It's just the most beautiful film.
And where does this fit into films from Agnes? Beaches of Agnes, you recommended to me, which I've seen, which is wonderful.
It's
is it very French cinema, or are we talking...
It's very unique Agnes cinema.
Right.
It's that thing that she does every time. I mean, she's a Bowie in herself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but she's never had the bad... she never went stadium.
Yeah.
You know, she's just got this... As she gets older, it's just fascinating to see her... how she sort of almost goes back into a sort of a very innocent... It's almost the older she gets, the more stripped down and innocent the subject matters are, the more important they are, the more that sort of they condense into things that are really mattering to her, things like friendship and communication and really very sort of beautiful ideas. And that, yet she creates these kind of beautiful, beautiful films and images. And this is a real collaboration, because all JR's work is, you know, it's on the side of, what do you call it, containers, on huge, big, you know, massive buildings, on all sorts of things. So they're trying to kind of get these images all over the country through sort of posting them on trains and planes and God knows what.
And what's his history? Who is JR?
Well,
is he
I don't know, to be honest,
I should
have done a little bit more research about JR. I looked him up, and he's got this is his work. It's sort of graffiti-based, beautiful photography.
If I want to see The White Bus, then, do I have to get a DVD from Australia?
Possibly, yes.
Right.
Or you could borrow mine.
What is The White Bus?
Yeah, just
the
tell
White
us a
Bus.
Tiny bit about...
It's very exciting.
Yeah,
For me, it's
Anderson.
Exciting. It's all set in Manchester in 1967, I think. And it starts off with a woman that's moved to London, and she's homesick, or she's not homesick, she's very depressed.
Mm.
And the first image you see of her is really sad. It's her having a fantasy of hanging herself in her office. And then she just jumps on a train to Manchester. It's all black and white. It's all not all black and white, half colour. She's on a train to Manchester with all these football supporters.
Mm.
And then she starts to sort of reconnect with herself through visiting this very surreal bus ride around her hometown, Manchester, and it's got Arthur Lowe in it, who's absolutely hilarious.
It sounds
the Lord
like the most
Mayor.
Morrissey thing ever invented. It's totally Smith.
It must have inspired, of course. And you know what? It was supposed to be part of a trilogy with films made by Tony Richardson and Carol Rice, and they were all short stories written by Sheila Delaney.
Ah,
even more Morrissey.
Amazing.
Extremely Morrissey.
Yes. So I can't recommend it enough. I don't know why it's not been, you know, it's only 47 minutes, which is also my favourite thing about it, because that's my favourite length of a film.
Mm-hmm.
3/4 of an hour.
Yeah. You should all be ordering this from Amazon Australia, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, we will try. Yeah. Mark Hooper, your choice. Tell us your emergency movie.
Yeah, The Duelists, which is actually Ridley Scott's directorial debut, and he actually won the Cannes Debut Award in 77, I think it came out. It's not at all what you'd imagine from a Ridley Scott film. You know, even then, you know, he was an ad man coming out of doing glitzy ads. It's basically, it's like a Stanley Kubrick historical drama, and it basically, it's based on a Joseph Conrad short story, and a kind of very art house, and it basically stars, and even more like Harvey Keitel and then Keith Carradine, and they're basically Napoleonic era French officers who one of them slights the other and they challenge them to a duel. So Harvey Keitel is kind of this revolutionary sort of, you know, part of the modern era, and then Keith Carradine is kind of aristocratic officer. And it's just this crazy film where they, you know, their paths cross continuously, and they never quite fulfil this duel, and it gets called off, or you know, one of them's wounded, and they have all these kind of rules. So when they keep bumping each other and start having a duel, and the Napoleonic Wars going on, and they're on the Eastern Front fighting the Russians, and they bump into each other, and they're like, right, we've got to have a duel again. It's crazy. It's kind of insane, but it's amazing. It's shot so beautifully. It's just.
So what makes it so special? Why should I watch it tonight?
I think like the camera work is amazing, the scenery, and the final scene where they kind of fight in this kind of ruins of an old castle, and they're kind of running up and down the valleys and stuff, and beautifully shot. And it kind of, in the way that Kubrick did it, feels like it's all natural lighting, doesn't feel. But it's also kind of like this weird poetic, and it also, the actual dueling scenes are really kind of visceral and quite scary, and you can see, like, you know, particularly Keith Carradine doesn't really want to be fighting this insane Harvey Keitel, and he's kind of trying to get out of it, and you can see him literally almost pissing himself when this guy's trying to chop his head off and stuff. It's so sort of, it's almost like that jarring thing of like beautiful, you know, beautifully shot scenery, and then this kind of sudden like attack, and just the fact it's kind of like a black comedy. So I was like, oh come on, seriously, not again. And at one point they're about to be killed by Cossacks, and they're like, they basically make it like, should we do this later and just like fight
this
the enemy
farcical
and like survive
well.
So that we can carry on this duel.
And can you see the sort of Blade Runner element, the Ridley Scottness of
I don't know, apart from things like films? There's a bit like at the end, there's a kind of a sunrise or sunset and the light, and you get that kind of lens flare, right, which almost looks quite sci-fi and stuff, but it doesn't feel like, you know, you wouldn't think it was him who made it.
There's no origami unicorns.
Andrew, you're essentially a robot in human form, I believe. So unsurprisingly, you've chosen a film with robots in it.
Yes, this is Silent Running, the great Douglas Trumbull's eco-fable in space. You'll know it. It's the one where Bruce Dern and three loyal robots, Huey, Dewey and Louie, are custodians of the last plants, the last vegetables, trees, bushes, and weeds, whatever, in the universe. The Earth has become polluted and destroyed very, very 70s. So a bunch of effectively greenhouses are shot off into space with Bruce Dern, the robots, and a bunch of horrible blokes. And the horrible blokes have no interest in their responsibilities towards the survival of the ecology of planet Earth. They just want to drive around on quad bikes and get drunk and smash into each other. And, you know, bit by bit, it becomes necessary for Bruce Dern to murder them in order to save the ecology of planet Earth. It has this very strange soundtrack with folky songs by Joan Baez. We heard one earlier. Mm. But I love the poignancy of it, of the faithful little robots, the little sort of servo robots who, you know, look after the irrigation and so forth, and Bruce Dern's incredible loneliness as he's literally the last man in the universe who cares about the health of a tree and a twig. It used to be a regular, it would not seem to be on every Wednesday night between about 1978 about 1983, when the BBC would show Hollywood movies on a Wednesday night before they filled it up with all the other stuff they came up with subsequently. It was directed by the great Douglas Trumbull, who was the models guy. He was the guy that would build, you know, the special effects, Close Encounters and anything. When models were practical models, they had to be handmade and shot with a particular lens to make them look huge when they were actually the size of a Tonka toy. And this was his kind of passion project. It was a total flop and a disaster, and he was really hurt by it. But I love it because it has got my favourite thing, which is... obviously, faithful robots is my favourite thing.
Yes.
But human kind of dedication in impossible circumstances, and I love it.
I've got it on my TiVo waiting to watch, so I should go and watch
Knock
it,
shouldn't
I? Knock
yourself out. Yeah. What's your choice for an emergency movie, Stan?
Well, there's toss-up between two, actually. So I do have to make special mention for The Greasy Strangler, which is one of the weirdest films I've ever seen in my life, yes. And I love it.
That's another Morrissey song, isn't it?
I think it might be. So that gets honourable mention.
Also produced by the same person that produced My Delia Short.
Hooray! Oh, really? Life is a Circle. That's wonderful. Go and see it if you can. But also very, very, very hard to find The Castle, which I've got on VHS somewhere. I think you can get it on DVD. It's an Australian film, 1997, yes. And features the Kerrigan family, who are perhaps the nicest, kindest, loveliest working class family that you've ever met in your life, whose castle is in fact this awful house that's right next to the airstrip. They are threatened with eviction because a big company wants to build, you know, further, and the airport is going to expand and their house is going to be knocked down, and they fight it. And it's just wonderful. It's catchphrase heavy. Tell him he's dreaming. The Daryl Kerrigan plays the dad, and his son is always looking up the ads in the Post. And they say, pair of jousting sticks, how much for? $100. Tell him he's dreaming. Oh, it's just wonderful. And I can't, straight to the poor, I can't do it justice. But there's something about the warmth of the family, their sheer delight in things that we scoff at, yeah, is just fantastic. And I mean, I hate the phrase heartwarming, but you just feel really amazingly brilliant about humanity after you've seen that film.
Mark, you have an Australian connection. Are you familiar with this film?
I am very, yeah. My wife's Australian. It was actually my best mate at school who emigrated to Australia, and I was best man at his wedding. And when I was out there to be at his wedding, he showed me this film on VHS. And we probably watched about 20 times. And like, it's really hard to find. I got a VHS copy from the ABC store in Perth, I think it was. And it's still quite, I think you must be able to get it on DVD now.
You can get it. Really, I did quickly look it up, but at one point it was only VHS. You could get
it
on eBay.
Got it in a stash, yeah, and yes, a mega stash of films you can't get from Australia. So The Castle,
yes,
then.
Oh,
the
Castle is fantastic. Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, well, we're coming to the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over the last bottle of French wine left before Brexit? Caroline, what will you be discussing as the glasses are swept away?
No Activity, which is again Australian. Mm-hmm. Apologies for my terrible accent. It's just probably the best thing I've seen for years on the television. It's quite hilarious. I know you're a bit of a fan,
yeah,
as
I just,
well.
I think, like, yeah, I just suddenly saw it on BBC Two sort of after I was watching something else.
What is it?
Got addicted.
Yeah. What happens?
Well, really, what happens is it's police, Stokes and Hendy. And they've got, they're absolutely bored coppers, stuck for hours and hours and days sometimes on this stakeout. So it's a sort of a series of these vignettes, yeah, of these couples. So you get Stokes and Hendy, you get Carol and Amy, they're on the radio, and they speak to Stokes and Hendy on the radio as well sometimes. And terrible things happen when the radio gets left on, sometimes on purpose, sometimes not on purpose, right, and they start talking about Amy or Carol or whoever, yeah, it is. So there's sort of many, many comedies of many, many eras. The whole episode, the whole series kicks off with Stokes and Hendy in the car, and they're obviously, you know, having a really important conversation about which hand you masturbate with if you're a Siamese twin. So that's how you begin the whole, this is the way, yeah, you're at. You don't know what they're talking about quite, and you think it's, yeah, important to the case, and, yeah, you realise what it is. And as the camera pulls out, there's a giant concrete dolphin sitting on the back seat because Hendy wanted to get it because he found it from an architectural warehouse place, and he wanted to pick it up and take it home to his wife.
And they're trying to be inconspicuous while they've got
this. So this is available on iPlayer, is it? It's on BBC Two.
It's great. There's two series.
Amazing. Yeah. It's an Australian film. We don't have to go to Australia,
exactly,
to get a VHS,
yes,
on. Fantastic.
And it's only half.
And
then
No Activities is brilliant because they keep calling in saying, you know, what's the status? And they just go, No Activity, and then carry on talking about
it. It sounds like, did anyone see Bakersfield PD, which was about two bored cops in Bakersfield? But it's amazing because it was so mundane.
Fantastic. Mark, what's your closing time chatter?
It's weirdly sort of tying in a few threads. Duncan Jones has just been announced as the director of the new Rogue Trooper film, which is a character who is in 2000 AD, one of my favourite. I'm not really massively into comics, but I was really into 2000 AD. I think there's something about them that kind of brought it beyond the comic world a bit, and this is kind of my favourite strip. I just kind of hope, I think he's the sort of guy who will really do it justice, but it's kind of a weird story where it's a kind of a the main character is this guy, Rogue, who's a they call them GIs, but it's like they say, blue-skinned mutant who's been genetically created to fight in this sort of nuclear wasteland, a place called New Earth. And basically the kind of main plot is there's a whole army of them, and they get betrayed by this someone who sort of changes sides, some general, and he's the only one left, so he's trying to find out what happened. But the great thing about it, he's got these three dead mates who he's carrying with him, who are basically, they're kind of preserved as like avatars within these chips, which are, you know, sort of embedded within them. So just before they die, he removes these chips and he's got them on different bits of his equipment. So he's got his dead buddies talking to him all the way through. So it's kind of got this brilliant, and they've all got very different personalities. One of them's very sort of gung-ho and quite sort of right-wing, and he's kind of like the car. And so he ends up, a lot of the moments, he's got his dead friends arguing with each other while he's like, shut up, guys, I'm trying to help out here and stuff. So I think it could be amazing if he...
Well, Duncan Jones apparently used to read 2000 AD with his dad.
Yeah,
so I like the idea of the dame and little Zowie Bowie reading, that kind of thing. Stan, what have you got?
Well, it's a Duncan Jones tip again. I was wondering about Duncan Jones Bowie Book Club, and that I had really, gone into this wholeheartedly and bought one book, the number one book, the Peter Ackroyd, although I read it before I'd lost the book. And then I kind of lost thread. So I have asked this morning on Twitter, as we broadcast, I haven't had the reply, what are we on yet, Duncan? Not that I know him, he might just think I'm trolling him. Because I quite like to get that back, and I think maybe I should just start my own book club and follow it that way and do a local thing. You know, I'm being a bit passive about it. I'm berating myself here. But yeah, if anyone does know, brilliant. Can you tweet me what book we're on? And I'd like to catch up, please.
Have you seen this picture? I know it's not. Look, Bowie do it. Have you
Caroline
seen
the showing us Caroline's Bowie and Zoe
of Bowie with little Duncan.
Isn't he beautiful?
Doing homework apparently.
Little kid. Yeah.
Throw your homework onto the fire.
Yeah. Well, not quite. It seems. Well, maybe it was 2000 AD.
Could be. Sorry. Well, my closing time chatter is a sad one, and it's also about 2000 AD. It's about the death of the great Carlos Ezquerra, the guy who designed Judge Dredd, designed that amazing uniform. He drew for Battle Picture Weekly. He drew Rat Pack. He drew Major Easy. He drew a fantastic character called El Mestizo for Battle Action Weekly, which was in a comic filled with Second World War stories where it's very hard to even get a First World War story off the ground. He put together this story about a former slave who escapes from captivity and fights in the American Civil War, and it was a real passion project for him. It's amazing. Carlos Ezquerra was from Zaragoza in Spain. He was always the joke in 2008 was that the writers and the artists were all robots. So occasionally there'd be a drawing of him, and he would be drawn like a matador, a robot matador, always with a cigar. He was prolific. He was amazing. He drew more pages of Judge Dredd than can be imagined. He drew Strontium Dog almost every single page of it. His artwork is totally inimitable. It owes almost nothing to the American style of comics. And it's kind of uniquely recognisable. It has this kind of strange rough pencil. And every character has thick, black, chunky lines like a magic mark around them. An absolutely unbelievable talent. He designed the look of Judge Dredd, and was then told he wouldn't be drawing the strip. So he disappeared for like 200 weeks and then came back and drew, with a couple of exceptions. Then he came back full time to draw a 26-part epic called The Apocalypse War. He drew every panel. I reread it this week. You've never seen such a variety of style, energy, everything from the tiniest moments to the literally cities being destroyed by nuclear warfare. And I don't think there'll ever be anybody like him ever again. And I was as saddened by the death of Carlos Ezquerra as I was by the death of David Bowie, because it's as if a whole sort of universe and a whole unique way of looking at the world has gone, and it's not going to come back. So RIP Carlos Ezquerra. And that's it. That massive downer is the end of the main bit of the show. Thanks to our special guests, Mark Cooper and Caroline Katt. You're going to stick around for the extra bit, yes? Good. Don't give them a chance to say no. Caroline, when is the Delia movie coming out again? When is the Delia movie going to be available to be seen?
The Delia movie will be available to be seen in the BFI London Film Festival 2018 on the 16th and 17th of October at the Prince Charles Theatre and also the View Leicester Square.
Okay, fantastic. And Mark, how can readers get Hole and Corner?
Well, easiest way is go to holeandcorner.com, and you can order it online from there. But we're in all good
All good news agents. All good news agents.
Boutiques.
And some rubbish ones as well. Remember, listeners, you can get the extra bit by going to patreon.com/bigmouth and signing up. Thanks to Sean Patton. Thank you for coming again, Sean. Mm. And it's a sad show because our producer, Jack Claremont, is leaving us. Jack has got a full-time job. I know, how dare he? And he's producing this last episode from home, so he's not in here with us. We're going to miss him a lot. He's been fantastic. Jack, if you're listening, and I hope you are because you're supposed to be editing this, good luck in all your future endeavours, and we'll see you around Soho Square. That's Big Mouth. We're back next week. See you then.